Welcome back to the South Harbor Church Podcast. South Harbor is a part of the Harbor Churches, which exist to help people find their way back to God. This week, Pastor Jeremy brings us a message where we look at one of Jesus' miracles that appears to have some complications. As always, for more information about how you can become a part of the South Harbor Church community, stick around after the message. And now, let's head over to Pastor Jeremy.
So good morning, South Harbor. My name's Jeremy, one of the pastors here. And this morning, I'm excited about what we get to do this morning. This morning, we get to look at a story in the book of Mark that, if I'm honest, through much of my life has been one of the harder stories for me to understand. It's been one of those problematic stories, one of those, like, as somebody who stands on a stage, opens the scriptures, and talks about a story, this is one of those stories that was always like, I hope I never have to preach that one, because it just felt problematic. The story we're going to look at this morning, it's a story where when we read it, you'll see it in a few minutes, when we read it, like, Jesus kind of messes something up. Like, Jesus kind of, like, he tries something, but it doesn't quite work. And so Jesus, like, he'll figure it out eventually. He'll do it again. But I never knew what to do with the story. It feels like Jesus messes something up in the story. And so for years as I would read it, I would find myself asking the question, like, what is actually going on? Did Jesus mess something up? And if so, like, is that the right way to read the story? If you want to follow along with us, we will be in Mark chapter 8 this morning. But before we go to the story, I want to just a word about kind of where we're at. Especially if you're newer with us, we started a series on the book of Mark a number of weeks ago. And so we're basically taking kind of 15 weeks, stepping back and asking the question, what is Mark doing in what we call a gospel? Gospel comes from the Greek word euangelion, means good news. So Mark writes an account of the good news of Jesus. And if you're newer with us, we're kind of walking through this one a little bit differently. Typically, when we go through a book, we kind of start at the beginning and we just kind of follow the book wherever it'll take us. This one, we're doing a little bit different. We're kind of stepping back. Granted, we spent like the first 4 weeks on the first verse of Mark. But after we got out of the first verse, now we're kind of asking the question, if Mark wants us to know who Jesus is, right? That's Mark's intent. That's why he writes the book, the account of Jesus. We're asking the question, what are some things that Mark says, in order to know Jesus, like, you need to know these things? And so what we're doing is we're kind of skipping around the book of Mark a little bit more, asking the question, what are those things that Mark says in order to understand who Jesus is? In order to understand what it means to be a follower of Jesus, like, these are the things you need to know. These are the stories you need to know. And so we're kind of bouncing around, asking those questions, looking at some of those stories. And so this morning, we get to go to the one that was, for years, one of the more problematic stories for me in much of the Bible, especially the Gospels, the stories of Jesus. And so I want to show it to you. Mark chapter 8, if you want to follow along, we'll be in five verses, kind of right in the middle of it. Mark 8, starting at verse 22, it says, they came to Bethsaida, which is a little kind of fishing village on the Sea of Galilee, and some people brought a blind man and begged Jesus to touch him. He took the blind man by the hand and led him outside of the village. So notice Jesus takes him outside of the village. When he had spit on the man's eyes and put his hands on him, Jesus asked, do you see anything? He looked up and said, I see people, but they look like trees walking around. Once more, Jesus put his hands on the man's eyes. Then his eyes were opened, his sight was restored, and he saw everything clearly. Jesus sent him home saying, don't even go into the village. Can we just name it's a weird story? It's a weird story. I've got my big problem with the story, my question in the story. But even before we get there, it's just a weird story. Like, first, the way Jesus heals the blind man. Jesus spits in the guy's eyes. Can we just all kind of, like, be grateful for the way eye medicine has improved over the years? right? Like, can you imagine you show up at the eye doctor like, hey, you know, things are a little bit fuzzy. They spit in your face and ask, no, I can't see better. Like, I've got phlegm in my face, right? Like, what are we doing? But Jesus spits in the guy's eyes. Now, just to kind of deal with the spit thing in the story, because to us, like, weird and gross, right? Like, I would love to see the way they try to, like, code spit in the bill to the insurance. But for us, weird and gross. Just kind of deal with that. Saliva in the ancient world was understood to have, like, healing properties. So, like, to their world, it wouldn't have been as crazy as what it is to ours. And if you want a deep dive, so, like, I'll give you kind of the front end of it, and then you can chase it if you want to. There was also a story that would be circulating kind of right around the time that Mark is writing the story. And the story went that there was an Egyptian god, a god by the name of Serapis. And there was this myth, this story, that this Egyptian god Serapis actually one time healed a blind man using the spit from the Emperor Vespasian. If you were here with us over the last number of weeks, you'll remember Vespasian was the emperor. He wasn't the emperor right after Nero, but he's kind of the emperor that finally, like, stabilized Rome after all of the chaos that was Nero. And if you were here during our first few weeks, you remember that to the Roman world, one of the big qualifiers for the emperor is we need to make sure they're divine, that they are gods. They're more than human. And so there is this story that kind of got circulated as propaganda that if anybody asked the question, like, okay, Vespasian, like, is he legit? Like, is Vespasian the one that we should see as king, as emperor? They'd say, well, I heard that his spit had the ability to cure blindness. And so is it possible that Jesus in our story already is doing something subversive? Oh, you've heard this story that was supposed to validate Vespasian as king, and Jesus steps on the scene and essentially says, bet, you've heard the story, watch me actually do it. So the spit thing, it's still weird and gross, but I think in the context, I think it makes a little more sense. But then I've got other questions with the story. So the spit, but then you notice, like, Jesus asks the guy if it worked. That's strange, isn't it? Like, through the Gospels, there's a number of times where Jesus will do something. He'll heal somebody, he'll raise somebody from the dead. What you almost never see is Jesus checking in to see if it worked. Right? Jesus will heal, like, paralyzed people that cannot walk. And what you don't see is Jesus, like, do a healing and then ask the guy, like, hey, can you wiggle your toes? Like, can you feel? Like, he doesn't do that. What he does is says, like, hey, get up, take your mat, and walk home. Jesus seems to assume that one worked. Right? Jesus will raise people from the dead. And when he raises people from the dead, Jesus doesn't, like, speak a word of healing and then, like, hey, can we get somebody to check for a heartbeat? Like, we got to make sure that this gets somebody get a pulse. Jesus just says, like, stand up and walk. Or Jesus has a friend, Lazarus. He's, like, in a tomb. He's dead. Jesus doesn't, like, hey, can you hear me? Like, are you? And yet in this story, Jesus, like, spits in the guy's eyes and then asks the question, like, hey, did it work? Did it work? Did Jesus not know if it was? What is Jesus doing there? Did Jesus not know if what he just did was actually going to work? And then you notice the guy's response, right? So, like, Jesus spits in his eyes, says, like, hey, did it work? And the guy says, well, I see people, but they look like trees. Now, to me, this raises a whole extra set of questions. One, how does the guy even know what a tree looks like, right? Like, so, okay, maybe he wasn't blind forever, but, like, how would a blind person know what a tree looks like? And then, like, if people look like trees, do trees look like people? And that's just terrifying, right? Why does the guy think he sees something, but it actually looks like something else? And then the whole thing just forces me to ask my biggest question, the biggest problem I have with the passage is simply the question, did Jesus mess up? Did he do it wrong? Like, did Jesus somehow, like, get the wires crossed? Because, like, he did something, right? Like, spitting in the guy's eyes, like, he saw more than nothing. But he didn't. It didn't work fully until Jesus kind of has to do it again. Question, did Jesus mess up? For years, I kind of wrestled with this question. The story never made sense to me because it looks that way, doesn't it? That like he tried, it didn't quite work, and then he tried again, and then it did. But something deep in me was like, okay, but that doesn't feel right. So I'd tried to kind of deep dive, like what are the answers? What are other people saying? Because the reality is people get really uncomfortable with that question, right? Like with the idea of Jesus messing something up. And so there have been a number of attempts to try to explain what happened. Let me give you a couple answers that I'd kind of seen along the way. Answer number one, maybe Jesus is still learning. Like maybe healing is hard. I mean, I've never done it. Like maybe healing like this is difficult. And so maybe Jesus, like we're in Mark chapter 8, so we're still a little bit early in kind of Jesus' ministry. Like maybe he's still trying to figure out like, how do I do this healing thing? And so he's kind of trying something out, but he doesn't quite nail it the first time. And on the one hand, like I've got no problem with Jesus like learning things along the way. Luke will actually name that Jesus grew in wisdom and stature. So like Jesus was not born as like the first infant astrophysicist, right? Like he didn't know everything. He learned things. And so is it possible that Jesus didn't fully know how to do this yet? And so he's kind of trying it out and Jesus learned from this how to do healings. It's an answer some people give. I always saw that answer and went, that just doesn't feel right. It doesn't feel consistent with the way the gospel writers, with the way Mark tells the story of Jesus. And so I always struggled with this answer. Do we struggle with the answer? I always struggled with the answer. So another answer people would give. Answer number two, this one would say, well, maybe it's because eyes are just extra complicated. Right, like healing somebody's legs, like that's easy, but healing somebody's eyes, like sight and eyes, like it's just more complicated. It takes a little bit more. And now, similar to the first one, like I feel like I can understand at least the basic premise. Eyes are really complicated. I actually sat at a basketball game a few weeks ago with a couple eye doctors. They actually go here, and they were telling me a little bit of like what they do for a job and some of the surgeries they've done, and like, part of me wanted to job shadow, and part of me knew they would be pulling me off the floor before, like, any of the fun. I'm one of those people that, like, even the idea of touching my eye, like, gives me, like, the, like, no. So maybe it's that, like, eyes are just extra complicated, and so healing somebody who can't walk, like, that's easier. Healing somebody's sight, like, ooh, that one's a doozy. Like, that one's harder. So maybe that one just took a little bit more. But I also have problems with that answer. Because it's not like healing somebody's legs are easy. Like I've talked to some of you who work in that field. That's also complicated. I watched the Olympics. Like I've seen the picture of the thing that Lindsey Vonn has on her leg. Like nothing looks easy about that. Legs aren't that much easier than eyes. And so I'd read this answer and go, I don't feel like I buy this answer. Like that doesn't feel to me. It feels like we're just trying to dismiss the question by giving just an easy pat answer without actually dealing with the question. And so I found myself just trying to figure out, like, what is Jesus doing? Did Jesus mess up? Is it that, like, he's still learning? Is it that eyes are more complicated? Or is something else going on in the story? And then there's a moment when I was given another question, kind of a question on top of the question, right? Those usually feel like they're the most helpful. And this question that I was given, to me, it kind of, like, it unlocked the story for me. It put me in a spot where I was able to step back and actually see the story in a way that it was no longer problematic, but all of a sudden, like, all of the pieces fit, the whole thing kind of locked in, and the whole story made sense. And that question, the question kind of on the question that helped unlock the story for me is, what if Jesus did the whole thing on purpose? Like, what if Jesus wasn't surprised by the guy's answer? When Jesus said, like, hey, did it work? Can you see? What if Jesus wasn't surprised by the response? What if it's the response Jesus was looking for? What if The entire story was how Jesus intended it to work. That question kind of sent me on a journey, kind of a deep dive of like, okay, if that's true, what does that mean? And so what I want to do is I kind of want to bring us on that journey this morning. But to start, we have to talk a little bit about like kind of how the Bible works or how we read the Bible. Because I think too often we could do what we kind of started with this morning is take five verses out of a larger book and assume that all we need to understand the story are simply those five verses from the middle of a book. But if we actually step back and think about that, it really kind of doesn't make sense, does it? The book of Mark is 16 chapters long. So we're right in the middle in chapter 8, and we're looking at five verses in chapter 8. What Mark isn't doing, I think one of the mistakes we can make when we come to the Bible, to stories like these, is we assume, maybe accidentally, unknowingly assume, that what Mark is just a bunch of kind of disjointed stories one after each other. Or that the Bible is a bunch of disjointed stories that are all just kind of held in a collection. When the reality is, Mark is telling a story. That these five verses are part of a much larger story that Mark is telling. And maybe in order to understand these five verses, we need to step back and look at the larger story that Mark is telling. I think we get this. So again, Mark 16 chapters, we're right in the middle. Imagine you were to show up. You're going to go to a movie. You're going to take the family to a movie. But you only watch 5 minutes in the middle of the movie. Would it be fair to assume that you can then understand the entirety of the movie from 5 minutes right in the middle? No. Example, let's say you watch The Lion King. Any like Lion King fans? Like you like the OG? So good. So if you show up at like 5 minutes in the middle of The Lion King, all you see is this like baby Simba like running and dancing in the jungle with Timon and Pumbaa, the young warthog. And you could, if you only watch 5 minutes, you could go to The Lion King, come out and go, oh, well, this is a story about like these jungle animals, about like casting off all of life's worries, right? Hakuna Matata. And in doing so, miss the entire plot of the entire movie. Let's do something a little more recent. You went to the movie Inside Out, right? And all you saw was 5 minutes in the middle. You leave thinking, oh, sadness is the villain, right? That's a bad guy. And if all you watch is 5 minutes into the middle of the movie, you miss the overall plot of the movie. You miss the story that's being told. It seems crazy that we think we could watch 5 minutes and go, oh, I get that story. That's all I need. And yet, how often we take Mark 8, five verses in the middle, and say, oh, all I need are those five verses, and then I'll try to like extrapolate an answer to the questions that I have of just these five verses. Does this make sense? So what I want to do, what if Jesus did it on purpose? The journey that question sent me on, that deep dive, started by just taking a step back and asking, okay, how then do these five verses fit in the longer story that Mark is telling? And so if we back up, Mark chapter 8, if we even start at verse 1, what we find in verse 1, and I'll kind of put the list up on the screen, but what we start in Mark chapter 8, verse 1, is we have the story of the feeding of the 4,000, that Jesus is going to show up. He shows up kind of on the shore of the Sea of Galilee. There are 4,000 people. Jesus has been teaching. The story says that he's been teaching for a few days, and he recognizes the people have been hungry. Of course, they're getting hungry. And so Jesus says, hey, we should do something about this. We should feed them. Then he asks his disciples, hey, how many loaves of bread do we have? They respond, they said, well, we've got about 7. And then I want to read the rest of the story. It says, Jesus told the crowd to sit down on the ground. When he had taken the 7 loaves of bread and given thanks, he broke them and gave them to his disciples to distribute to the people, and they did so. They had a few small fish as well. He gave thanks for them also and told the disciples to distribute them. The people ate and were satisfied. Afterward, the disciples picked up 7 basketfuls of broken pieces that were left over. About 4,000 were present after he had sent them away. He got into the boat with his disciples and went to the region of Dalmanutha. So Jesus has 4,000 people. He's got 7 loaves of bread. He breaks those 7 loaves of bread, sends them out to feed the people. Does Jesus then ask the disciples, like, hey, was there enough? Did it work? No, we didn't ask. He knew it was going to work. And so Jesus sends it out, feeds 4,000 people with simply 7 loaves of bread. The disciples and Jesus then, we read, they get in a boat and they head to the region of Dalmanutha. It's another region on the Sea of Galilee. It's kind of right where like Magdala, Mary Magdalene is kind of from that region. But on the boat, what we find, so the first story in Mark 8 is a feeding of 4,000. Right afterwards, they get on the boat. Mark is then going to tell us about this discussion that happens on the boat. Let's go ahead and read it. It says this. It says, the disciples had forgotten to bring bread. So the disciples, they get in a boat, they forgot lunch, except for one loaf they had with them in the boat. Be careful, Jesus warned them. Watch out for the yeast of the Pharisees and that of Herod. Okay, so the disciples, again, they've got only one loaf of bread in the boat. Jesus then wants to warn them about something. He wants to warn them, he says, about the yeast of the Pharisees and that of Herod. So what is Jesus doing? Well, first, Jesus is using this metaphor of yeast. Yeast was a common metaphor in Jesus' world. Yeast is used to make bread. In their world, you use yeast to make bread every single day. The friends that Tim and I and many of you have over in Israel, their minds are still blown at the fact that we in America buy bread for the week. They're like, we buy bread for the day. If we need bread today, we buy bread today. If we need bread tomorrow, we buy bread tomorrow. In Jesus' world, yeast was used all the time in bread, and yeast is actually fascinating. Like if you're one of the people, I got really into sourdough for like 3 weeks during COVID, right? I put on like 5 pounds and I threw my starter away. Like it was a delicious 3 weeks, and that was gonna get out of hand. But yeast is as fascinating. Like you take dough, you add a little bit of yeast, and without even knowing it, that yeast has a way of like getting into all of the dough and transforming all of it. And so Jesus will often use yeast as a way of explaining the teachings of the Pharisees and that of Herod. If you let even a little bit in, Jesus says, it might have a way of finding its way into all of it. It might impact everything. And so there's a whole other sermon to be preached on this, but essentially yeast of the Pharisees, the teachings of the Pharisees was essentially, you can sum it up around like kind of self-righteousness. It was a lot of hypocrisy. It was a lot of legalism. The yeast of that of Herod, there was a group of people that were kind of in with Herod. We know them as the Herodians in the scriptures. And essentially they said they were about kind of political compromise, that you can cozy up with Rome and also still be a follower of God. And Jesus is saying, hey, be aware of the yeast of these teachings, because if you let these things in, they might have a way of impacting all of it. So Jesus says, hey, guys, be on guard. But what's fascinating in the story is the disciples completely miss it. They aren't even close. Check out what the disciples, Jesus says, beware of the yeast of the Pharisees and that of Herod. And the disciples says they discussed this with one another and said, it's because we don't have bread. The disciples completely miss the point. They think Jesus is talking about yeast because they forgot to bring bread with them in the boat. All they have, after all, is just that one loaf of bread they left in the boat. So they're terrified that, like, oh, Jesus is getting on us because we forgot to bring lunch. Jesus hears the conversation. Jesus is going to come back. Jesus says this. He says, aware of their discussion, Jesus asks them, why are you talking about having no bread? Do you still not see or understand? Are your hearts hardened? Do you have eyes but fail to see and ears but fail to hear? And don't you remember when I broke the 5 loaves for the 5,000, a story that came a little bit earlier, how many basketfuls of pieces did you pick up? Well, 12, they replied. And when I broke the 7 loaves for the 4,000, how many basketfuls of pieces did you pick up? They answered 7. He said to them, do you still not understand? Some of you, are you starting to see like some connections in what Jesus is doing? There's a statement Jesus makes to his disciples on this boat that when I kind of went on this dive, it leapt out at me. It's that statement right at the beginning on the slide. Jesus says, "Do you have eyes but fail to see?" So what is Jesus doing? Well, if we go back to the timeline. In the beginning of chapter 8, Jesus feeds 4,000 people with only 7 loaves of bread. Jesus multiplies it. That 7 loaves of bread is enough for 4,000 people on the hillside. The disciples get into a boat and immediately go, "Oh no, we only have 1 loaf of bread for all of us." They have just seen Jesus feed way too many people with way too little bread. They get into a boat and go, "Oh, with just one loaf of bread isn't enough for us." And Jesus says, "Do you have eyes but fail to see? You're seeing what I'm doing, but you're missing what I'm actually about." The very next thing that happens, that Jesus feeds 4,000 people, they get on a boat, they have this conversation, like, "Oh no, we don't have enough bread for just us." The very thing that happens when they show up on the shore is the story we looked at this morning, but I want to read it again. I get we've already read it. I want to read it again just to see if, like, knowing it in context, if some, like, light bulbs start to go off. So they came to Bethsaida, and so people brought a blind man and begged Jesus to touch him. He took him outside of the city, of the village. When he had spit on the man's eyes and put his hands on him, Jesus asked, "Do you see anything?" He looked up and said, "I see people. They look like trees walking around." Once more, Jesus put his hands on the man's eyes. Then his eyes were opened, his sight was restored, and he saw everything clearly. So if we throw that one on the timeline, the disciples, they see Jesus feed 4,000 people with 7 loaves of bread. They get into a boat and they get really worried because they don't think they have enough bread for just them. And then Jesus will bring them right to the shore in Bethsaida, will come to a blind man, will heal the blind man the first time. He sees, but he doesn't see clearly. Second time, he will fully heal the man. The question, did Jesus mess up? Was Jesus still learning how to do healings? Is it that, like, eyes are just more complicated than everything else? Like, it was a little bit harder for him. In the context of the story, I would say absolutely not. What Jesus is doing is Jesus is teaching his disciples a lesson. I think it's why Jesus pulls the blind man outside of the village, right? Is it because Jesus didn't know if it was going to work, so he didn't want people to see him mess up? Or was Jesus doing something in this healing? Often when we look at kind of the miracles and the healings of Jesus, they might sometimes just appear as kind of random things that Jesus is doing, but most of the time, Jesus is doing what he's doing in order to teach the people around him something. And so in the story, why does Jesus pull him outside of the village? Because Jesus needed to teach his disciples something. That just, they had seen him heal 4,000. They then got worried that they had enough for themselves. Jesus says, "You have eyes, but you do not see." And then Jesus comes to a blind man. He heals him first. He can see, but he doesn't see properly. He doesn't see rightly. And then Jesus heals him a second time, and he sees things as they are. I think Jesus is bringing his disciples there. He's doing the healing the way he does because Jesus wants the disciples to see that they, in a lot of ways, are like that blind man. That they are seeing what Jesus is doing, but they're missing the full extent of what Jesus is about. That they saw him feed 4,000 people on a hillside, and yet moments later in a boat, they go, "Oh no, we don't have enough for ourselves." They have eyes, but they fail to see. And so Jesus brings them to this moment, heals this blind man as a way of telling his disciples, this is how you're living. They have eyes, but they fail to grasp what Jesus is actually about. They see what he's doing, but they don't yet trust him with their lives. I think it actually helps me make sense of the story that actually comes next in the timeline. Mark is doing something after all. The story that comes next, we've kind of alluded to it and read it a few times already in the series, but I want to look at it one more time because I think in light of this, it even makes more sense. If we go to the timeline, the next story that happens is Jesus will bring his disciples to the region of Caesarea Philippi. And again, we've read it before, but I want to show it again. This happens at Caesarea Philippi, if we go to that next slide. So Jesus and disciples went on to the villages around Caesarea Philippi. On the way, he asked them, "Who do people say that I am?" They replied, "Some say John the Baptist, others say Elijah, still others one of the prophets." "What about you?" he asked. "Who do you say I am?" Peter said, "You are the Messiah, the Christos, the King." Peter in this moment, like, he gets it. Like, he sees, like, Jesus, this is who you are. He makes this giant declaration, "You are the Messiah." And then the thing that happens immediately afterwards, right afterwards, it says, Jesus then began to teach them about what the Son of Man must suffer, many things, and be rejected by the elders, the chief priests, and the teachers of the law, and that he must be killed and after 3 days rise again. He spoke plainly about this, and Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. This is the moment when Peter, when Jesus is going to do the whole, like, "Get behind me, Satan." But what we find in the story is that on the one hand, Peter, like, sees who Jesus is. "You are the Messiah, the Christos, the Christ. You are the King." But Peter fails to understand what that still means. That in the story, Peter has eyes, but he still fails to see Jesus clearly. He has eyes, but he fails to see. See, where I find the story so incredibly helpful, I think for us, for the church today, is in the story, I think one of the reasons Jesus does the whole healing is because Jesus needs his disciples to see something that I think Jesus needs us to see. And what Jesus needed his disciples to see is that it wasn't simply enough to know what Jesus did. It wasn't simply enough to know the things that Jesus did, but the things that Jesus did shouldn't just be things they agree to in their heads, but should actually influence and transform the way they live their lives. That it's one thing to believe that Jesus fed 4,000 people on a hillside. And it's another thing to trust him when you're in a boat and you worry about whether or not you have enough for yourself. And Jesus said, I want you to know about me. But it's more than that. If that knowledge about me does not find its way into the way you actually live your life, Jesus says we're missing something. Jesus wants them to see that you have eyes, but in so many ways you fail to see. There's a gap between what you've seen me do and who you would affirm that I am and how that finds its way into the way you live your life every single day. See, I worry for us in kind of the church today that in so many ways we've reduced what it means to be Christian. Right, that like I worry that in many ways we've reduced what it means to be Christian to be simply like a bullet point list of things that we believe to be true, right? And that's important. Believing things to be true are important, but if we have a disconnect between who we believe Jesus is and how we actually live our lives, I think Jesus is calling us to step back and to recognize that one of the things we give ourselves to, if you're somebody who claims to be a follower of Jesus, is to try to decrease that gap as much as we're able, right? I worry that too often if what it means to be a follower of Jesus is just a bullet point list of things that we agree to, then heaven forbid we actually disagree with some of those things on the bullet point list, right? And then how many times have we seen people be really nasty with one another because we disagree with what should be in the bullet points, right? They're like, we would say, oh, Jesus calls us to love our neighbor. And yet in so many ways, we see people be completely nasty to one another about who it actually is that Jesus meant when he says we're supposed to love our neighbor. And is it possible that in doing that, we are completely, like the disciples in the boat, we are completely missing the point of what Jesus is wanting us to do, that there's a gap between who we believe Jesus is and how we actually live our lives. Part of the reason Jesus was so intentional about this is because I think Jesus recognized that this, how his disciples lived, this is the key that was going to change the world. That if his disciples, if they went out and just told people a bunch of bullet points, I don't know that would have made the impact that his disciples actually did by going out and actually embodying the ways of Jesus, by actually living the words and the ways of Jesus in their world. So much so, I think Jesus believed in this so deeply. Jesus was a rabbi after all, right? We've talked the last handful of weeks about how to the rabbis, the intent wasn't just to like have your disciples learn a bunch of things from you, but the intent was to have you carry the teaching, carry what they called their yoke, to become like their rabbi. And Jesus knew that if his disciples could do it, if they could go out and model his way in the world would never be the same. And there's a fascinating, if we fast forward the story, about 300 years, I think we actually have evidence of it actually working. There's an emperor, a guy who lived in the 300 ADs. His name is Flavius Claudius Julianus. How great a statue is that? Like, man, it's great. And then we have some of the, like, we have Dwayne Wade statue we made today, and they made that in the ancient world. That thing's amazing. But in about 300, Flavius Claudius Julianus, he's also known as Julian the Apostate, because Julian the Apostate, Flavius Claudius Julianus, stood against the way of the church. He was the guy that kind of came in charge kind of right after Constantine. You might know Constantine. Constantine is the emperor who essentially declared Christianity to be the official religion of the empire. So Christianity is not being persecuted. It is now the official religion of Rome. Julian the Apostate comes in and says, I want to undo everything Constantine did. So Julian, Flavius Claudius Julius, he wanted to undo Christianity as kind of the main religion. He wanted to stomp it out. He wanted to go as far as to persecute the Christians. But what he found is that he had a major issue in his agenda and what he wanted to do. I'll let him kind of name it. He said, those Christians, he said, take better care of Romans who are in need than we even do. They not only take care of their own, but they take care for any Roman, whether they be Christian or not. Julian the Apostate wants to wipe out Christianity, and his problem was that the Christians were so well respected in their world that he couldn't actually do it. It's hard to persecute a group of people that everybody loves being around. The early Christians, they recognized it wasn't enough just to debate theology. They were also feeding the hungry. They were doing the work. They were living out those ways and the words of Jesus in their world. I love the quote for them, and it makes me lament a little bit of like, is the church still known for that? Right, for being such good news that the world would not be as good of a place if the church did not exist. It makes me lament some of what the church is maybe known for. But then the story makes me ask a question. What do we do with this? Where do we go with it? One of the questions this story causes me to ask is simply this. Where am I like that blind man? What areas in my life are there are things that I believe to be true, and yet there are ways that I live my life that maybe don't necessarily go hand in hand, right? I believe that on that day, Jesus fed 4,000 people on a hillside. I believe that happened. How many times then do I, like the disciples in the boat, worry that I might not have enough? What does it look like for me to trust that not just that Jesus did do it, but that Jesus can and will? What does it look like for me to actually trust him in that? And what does it look like to do more than just believe things happen, but actually trust him with my life? In what ways can I, as I kind of walk out of here today, shrink that gap between the things I believe to be true and how I actually live my life? I'll close with a story. When I was in seminary, one of the kind of like capstone projects. So seminary's over. You're kind of right at the end. You have to write a paper. It's called a credo. Credo is Latin for I believe. And you have to write this giant paper naming all of the things you believe. And one of my peers, I'll never forget the way he started his credo. It'll stick with me forever. He started his credo by saying, I want to be clear that what follows in this paper are a bunch of things that I think are true. This, what follows, is not necessarily what I believe. So if you want to know what I think, that follows. If you want to know what I believe, you should probably follow me around and see the way I actually live my life. And what he said is like, if you want to know what I think about generosity, oh yeah, read the paper. But if you want to know what I actually believe about generosity, you should probably pay attention to the way that I steward my resources. If you want to know what I think about forgiveness, yeah, it's in chapter 3. But if you want to know what I actually believe about forgiveness, you should see the way I interact with people who have hurt me. If you want to know what I think about what Jesus meant to love my neighbor, yeah, go ahead. But if you want to know what I believe, you should watch the way that I interact with people online. You should see the way that I respond when somebody cuts me off in traffic. Because this paper will give a bunch of things that I think are true. But Jesus didn't just call us to do that. Jesus called us to live a certain type of way that the things that we believe to be true find their way into our lives in the way that we actually live. After all, when Jesus saw those disciples on the shore, right? When Jesus saw the disciples on the shore that day, he didn't ask them just to believe in him. He asked them to follow. He asked them to give their lives. He asked them to uproot everything and let him transform every single piece of them. So the question, where am I like the blind man? And what does it look like for me to shrink that gap as I continue to try to chase after my rabbi to follow? Would you pray with me? God, we do pray that you would open our eyes to the gaps that might exist in our lives between the things that we affirm, the things that we know are true, the things that we believe, and the way not all of those necessarily find their way into the way that we live our lives. God, we pray that the knowledge we have of you would transform us, that we would be renewed, as Paul says. God, we just pray that we would chase after you, that as we know more, as we learn more, as we continue to follow, that we would become, that we would start to look more and more like you. You are Rabbi. God, we pray this all in Jesus' name. Amen.
For more information about how you can become a part of the South Harbor Church community, find us on the web at www.southharbor.org. Or find us on Facebook and Instagram at South Harbor Church. And on Sunday mornings, you can find our service streamed live at 8:45 a.m. on Facebook and YouTube. And so from all of us here at South Harbor Church and the Harbor Churches, we want to wish you a blessed week.